healthcare has always been a bit upside down. It's typically controlled by physician leaders who put the person in a different sort of place in that continuum. In fact, one of the things I did both at One Medical and Sutter was ban the word patient, because from the Latin, literally the word patient means from a place of suffering. That should be a temporary state at best. We need to use technology effectively. The companies, particularly in healthcare, that bring to life the value proposition that their brand has and then create some sort of a demand structure that gets people to recognize its importance, again, this combination of brand and demand, they'll win in the long term. Consumers will win as well because they'll recognize the value that these brands are bringing, and we can live our lives in a healthier, better state.
Hey, it's E.B. Moss, and Happy New Year. This is the first episode of 2021, and it's episode 22 of Insider Interviews. As you may know, I'm the editor of a new publication all about the intersection of brand and demand marketing. And one of the folks that contributed to the January issue is Ara Yurganian. He has been a five-time CMO. He was the CMO at Sutter Health and at One Medical, and he's passionate about the need to have that intersection between brand and demand, as they say. He's won Chief Marketing Officer Award from the International CMO Club to the Q Award from Quigley Simpson. He's also a passionate board member and evangelist for the American Red Cross. So I loved talking to him because I learned about the social determinants of health and how they really affect how marketing decisions are made. What that means is that these days, so many aspects of our social existence impact our risk of disease. Think about those in more, let's say, fortunate zip codes or upscale zip codes have better access to nutrition, to stress reduction, to better environmental issues. It's not fair, and we need to find a way to spread the wealth and health across all zip codes. So we're going to talk about marketing healthcare, the data around that, and how to balance those social determinants of health with Ara Yurganian. Thanks for listening. Ara, thanks for joining me on Insider Interviews. And with healthcare being on everyone's mind, aside from you being, you know, one of the preeminent CMOs in healthcare marketing, how else would you describe yourself?
So I describe myself as a customer experience evangelist, one who's truly obsessed with consumers, the consumer journey, and the behavior that then becomes apparent once that consumer journey is addressed. But, you know, most importantly, I'm a dad, I'm a husband, and I'm very involved in our community. I care deeply about the place that we live so that it becomes better for all of us.
Well, I'm sure your kids are happy that you have your priorities straight. And for our audience, how would you prioritize what's new in marketing health and wellness? Are there any new approaches you've seen, especially given the need for consumer trust, such as marketing telehealth, and then how SDOH affects how marketing decisions are being made across brand and demand?
I think to start, it's important to define what social determinants of health means to me, commonly referred to as SDOH. Social determinants of health is sort of a technical way to think about one's longevity as it relates to the environment. So I like to say, for the first time, probably in our lifetime, one zip code is more directly related to your longevity than your genetic code. So what that really means is access to things like great medical care, access to clean air, good food, nutritious foods, education, safe places, gun-free zones will dictate for many how their lives will play out. And what's sad today is that so many are living in difficult situations where they don't have access to these basic necessities. And of course, we're not talking about third world countries. We're talking about the United States of America in major metropolitan areas. And you don't have to go too far. I live in one of the largest, most sophisticated cities in the country, San Jose, California, the bastion of Silicon Valley, really the birthplace of creativity and innovation. And every day when I drive the streets of San Jose, I see homeless encampments, people living under the bridges, intersections, just awful situations. And those are just people who are homeless. Imagine those that are living in impoverished situations in a domicile where they don't have access to the things that matter most, that give you that opportunity to change your lot in life. And that might be nutritious food. It might be being in a place that's safe, being in an environment that allows you to go to school and pursue an education. So we're at this critical juncture, I think, both economically and within our society, around how we take advantage of the gifts that we have as individuals who are more privileged, per se, and how we give back to the communities that don't have the same means that we do. Because if you think it only affects those individuals, think differently. I think if you imagine the people that you interact with who may not be vaccinated, who may not be getting the right sorts of treatment, and then lo and behold, them exposing you to disease states or conditions, it's not because you weren't careful about your own self. It's because you didn't care enough necessarily to help those who are less advantaged. And sure enough, that affliction translates then to you and into your community and to the places that you think you wouldn't imagine seeing these same sorts of challenges. You know, we think about crime. I mean, gun violence in the U.S. is abhorrent, and basic education that prevents us from having guns that are used in really nefarious ways can change the trajectory of our lives. So big opportunity here for us to think differently. And social determinants of health really need to be embraced at, I think, the medical and health and wellness levels in ways we hadn't imagined. It's one of the reasons why prevention, going into the inner city, looking at ways to administer care to people who aren't necessarily coming to the centers of care, matter most. And the health system shouldn't just be there for those who can afford to pay typically exorbitant fees. It should be for those who don't necessarily have the means, so that they too have the same privileges that those who don't have.
I read an interesting stat in one of the white papers on this from Code, that the life expectancy of the author's 2-year-old granddaughter and her quality of life could be shorter and lesser than the author's. And that's in, you know, going into 2021 America.
Right.
And yeah, we're like 28th in quality care and health survival rates or something in the world. It's amazing.
No, these are unusual times. I've often said that my kids may be the first generation in many who really have many choices ahead of them, but they may see life expectancy on average for their generation be lower because of these skewed factors that we just discussed. It's a really tough situation to embrace, but we need to address these concerns immediately. And I think bringing access to good healthcare is critical. For example, this new wave of telehealth, telemedicine, enables individuals to get the access they need when they want it, when they need it, in a frictionless way. So it's funny, I spent several years as the CMO of Sutter Health and the same at One Medical. And in particular at One Medical, I used to talk about creating a frictionless experience. And I felt that that was most important. What that meant to me was be available when the person who needs that care wants that care, and make that affordable and make it in a way that meets the needs and demands of that individual. And how do you democratize healthcare? You know, healthcare has always been a bit upside down. It's typically controlled by physicians and physician leaders who put the person in a different sort of place in that continuum. In fact, one of the things I did both at One Medical and Sutter was ban the word patient, because from the Latin, literally the word patient means from a place of suffering. That should be a temporary state at best. We all may be patients at some time, but it shouldn't be the standard norm for you to be referred to as the patient. Think about those days where you had to wait in the waiting room for that doctor who wasn't necessarily prompt and on time. Hopefully, telehealth is changing that paradigm. One Medical is changing that paradigm. The consumerization of healthcare is changing that paradigm. And this connection between brand and demand has, I think, democratized for many of these organizations the need to sort of change the conversation, to put the consumer now at the forefront of that service model, not sitting in line behind the provider who we typically were at the mercy of. And look, there are great physicians and physicians' assistants and nurses and nurse practitioners who care deeply about your care. but they often get swallowed up by the system that requires them to see 35 people a day, you know, and maybe you get 3 minutes. So if in fact that's the case, why not let telehealth take the burden away from those providers and create a situation where there's an incentive for that provider to provide great care and take the time that they that the person who's being consulted or treated demands. That's, I think, the change that needs to happen today.
So two questions. What did you replace the word patient with? And how did you help sort of push that thinking out across your broader organization? I mean, words are powerful, so I applaud that. But how did you market the reframing of the phrase?
So it's less complicated than you'd imagine, EB.
You had to stick a dollar in the penalty box or what?
No, I mean, just to think about the nomenclature, we're people, right? At One Medical, we called the people that we cared for members. We used their name. So it wasn't a dehumanizing experience to come into the doctor's office. And I think that is transformative unto itself, to actually call you by name. And I know it's difficult. It's very difficult because it's become second nature for us to refer to the patient experience, for example. Mm. And I think we have to think about it as a customer journey, right? It's as if you were in any fine restaurant or hotel. You know, when you leave a hotel, you're often thanked for your visit and they use your name. When you leave a hospital, you're discharged. It's another word that I banned. You know, Why would we ever discharge somebody? It sounds so technical and so cold. And I think it's very important for us to realize that these are journeys that consumers are on. And if in fact we're thinking about this concept of brand and demand as it relates to healthcare, in order for there to be demand, there needs to be a brand essence, a value proposition that really matters to the individuals who are being cared for so they return. Because again, my theme, and I'm going to beat this until it's dead, is consumers have choice.
I love that. And thanks for bringing it back to the brand and demand intersection for health and wellness. So let's continue down the path a little bit of SDOH. And there's so much data available about the impact of, you know, those surrounding communities and the deficits that happen to people or members. And so how are healthcare facilities managing all that data and then applying it? And talk also, please, about that value-based, you know, versus fee-for-service aspect.
Sure. You know, value-based programs obviously reward healthcare providers with incentive payments for providing quality of care and high-quality care. And that's typically tied in some way to Medicare. It's a unique opportunity to provide great service to individuals who candidly need that service. You know, I'll go back again to the One Medical example. Part of the ethos of the company was to spend as much time with individuals as was warranted. So you don't cut them off. You let them bring multiple challenges that they're facing to the conversation and have a real conversation with the provider that they're sitting with, the physician or nurse practitioner. That's a change in healthcare that I think really should be mimicked and modeled elsewhere if, in fact, the system, the large health system, really values the relationship with the person that they're providing care to. So I think that's a critical element to the continuum.
And on the data of the surrounding community.
Yes.
Because how do you track if that person is exposed to environmental ills, or if that person is eating a lot of bad food, or, you know, the sort of recidivism of healthcare facilities, are those two areas of data at all coming together?
So, EB, I think this is the challenge. It starts certainly with education. It starts when kids are in elementary school. It starts with nutritious programs that are served in class. It starts with diet and exercise. It can't just be one without the other. Throughout our lives, we learn that the only way that this whole continuum works is if you somehow work off the calories that you intake, and that helps you remain healthy and keeps your blood flowing. But you know, we're in a quandary today with COVID-19. I know my kids haven't been to school since last March, and it becomes much more of a challenge for individuals who don't have, you know, doting parents who care about the food intake and ensure that they're getting nutritious meals throughout the day. So then magnify that by young adults and people who don't necessarily have the means to shop and be considerate about the food that they're shoving into their mouth. They may be going to fast food restaurants, or they may be getting food that's certainly not nutritious or balanced. It's certainly a recipe for disaster, no pun intended, that impacts the lives of these individuals as they get older. So if you think about the person who lives in an inner city location as a child, who's exposed to the bus line that goes by and dispels these fumes in the air, and that child is playing throughout their young life in that environment and breathes in that air, perhaps the result of that experience doesn't manifest itself till later. But that same child, because both parents are working, is sort of scraping together food or eating leftovers or things that aren't nutritious or junk food throughout the day. Those problems manifest later. Then let's say they're not going to a park that may be nearby because where they live is congested and they can't cross a busy street. That situation manifests itself later because they're not exercising. They're not doing the things that they need to do. They're sitting in front of the TV, or perhaps just playing video games or looking at their phones all day. Those are recipes, again, that'll manifest longer term in ways that really affect health. So you may not feel it when you're young, but when you become 30, 35, 40, 45, and you have multiple chronic conditions like type 2 diabetes or coronary heart disease or other debilitating illnesses that are particularly related to obesity and a lack of general good health hygiene, then this situation manifests itself in a way that affects your longevity. And it's very hard to break that cycle. So it's so important that the data that we're thinking about somehow be materialized and communicated to individuals almost at every stop. If you can get healthcare workers to go to a community center and bring these people in and share with them, particularly the parents, the impact that their choices make on their kids' long-term health, that might be the dose of medicine, so to speak, that cracks the code. I think we somehow have to internalize what's happening. And with a multi-generational view, I think now we've seen this long enough to know that these individuals, parents, perhaps siblings of the parents, have died prematurely because of the lack of things we've talked about. All of these elements then play a role, hopefully, in changing behavior, because it's ultimately going to be an educational exercise and a behavioral change exercise.
How can some of the aligned products or brands, whether it's a sleep aid or gym facility or a yoga mat manufacturer or a bicycle manufacturer, how can they leverage some of the healthcare data and apply that to their marketing as well?
So I'm wearing a fitness tracker right now, and I'm conscious as well of my sleep. And if soon within the clothing that we wear, in the shoes that we put on every day, there'll be tracking devices that they already exist that'll provide lots of feedback around the type of experience we have throughout our lives. So I think the data will ultimately provide great insight that then should be communicated through the healthcare service or provider network, so that the data really does prove in a way that's indisputable that the actions, the behavior that you take will have an impact on your life and your life's course. I think education, I've said it over and over again, is the course multiplier, right? That is what ultimately will help individuals recognize that a behavioral shift needs to take place. And if, in fact, enough information is disseminated, then I think individuals will start taking seriously the challenges that perhaps they've overlooked throughout their lives.
And is there a privacy concern where all of that personal data influences, my purchase or my care?
There's an underlying privacy concern with us about everything that we do today. You know, I was thinking about how simple life was when I was younger, and we didn't have cell phones and tracking devices and mechanisms that we could sort of just look all the time at what was going on around us and track loved ones, et cetera. Look, it's the reality of our day. So I think businesses have got to be thoughtful about the way they manage data. I think most are trying to do so. There needs to be measures of security that are observed that enable us to trust the organizations to which we're disseminating information about ourselves. We hear about data breaches all the time, but I'm thinking that companies, organizations are getting smarter about the way they're tracking and managing the data they have. And listen, healthcare providers are, let's face it, most vulnerable because the data is so valuable and they've got to take extra precautions to ensure that there's trust along the way. Think about your own behavior. I know 15 years ago, I would have been very reluctant to give my credit card number to a website where there's no live person on the other end who I've developed a little bit of a relationship and perhaps trust with. And today we hand out our credit card information like it's candy. So I think we will overcome some of the challenges that we face, but I'm confident that we'll ultimately get over this hurdle as well. And yes, there'll be periodic breaches, but as long as organizations are learning from this experience and fortifying the walls as they continue to grow and mature, we'll all be better off with this data dissemination that hopefully is being used for good.
So overall, do you advise clients to embrace either more brand or more demand? Where do you fall on, so to speak, the continuum?
So I have a philosophy around when an organization has the right to market, when to sort of leverage that brand. And I think two things have to happen before any real marketing activity takes place. Number one, the product has got to be absolutely awesome, differentiated, have a unique value proposition, really be fantastic, special in many ways. And two, maybe even more importantly, the customer experience, that customer journey has got to be second to none. It's got to be ironclad. It's got to be filled with surprise and delight. It has to have opportunities where individuals engage in a meaningful way. If in fact those two buckets, you can say check, check, then I think a brand has the right to go out there and market effectively. And we've seen many examples of brands that do that well. And we've seen examples of brands that don't do that well. And when companies get themselves into trouble, then it does affect demand. So brand and demand to me really is this balancing of when to go out and really build a marketing sort of continuum and program mixed with then what does that demand curve and an effort kind of look like.
Two last questions. Did you ever have to market against Dr. Google? Patients deferring to Google for diagnosing themselves versus going to the doctor?
I think earlier in my career, as it relates to healthcare, it was more apparent. Still, certainly when people are diagnosed with a chronic condition or challenges that they face, whether they be perceived as severe or not, the first place people go is to the internet. And they certainly want to seek information. In fact, I think today the stat is more than two-thirds of the individuals who enter the session with their physician have already done research on conditions they think they might have, and they bring those in a long list to talk about oftentimes. So yes, it's definitely apparent. But again, I think information is absolutely the great equalizer. And the fact that they're actually doing research shows that they care. It opens up that door to, well, how can we help you live a better life? Because at the end of the day, I want individuals to remain consumers of life substantially longer than they become consumers of healthcare. And I think we realize that health insurers want that too. You know, there's a wonderful program called Silver Sneakers that when you become Medicare, Medicaid eligible at the age of 65, you're then offered typically for free. And the reason why Humana and Aetna and the Blues, et cetera, Anthem are so excited about this program is because they know that people who exercise and remain socially connected, not socially isolated, live longer. They actually cost the healthcare system less. They're more accustomed to take the medication that they've been provided. So they're happy to foot the bill for that gym visit because individuals who care for themselves through exercise and human connection are significantly healthier long-term. I think that's the great challenge with an epidemic, a pandemic that we've seen now for almost a year. It's particularly isolating for those who are of a higher risk class, who are now shut in and afraid to leave their homes. And I've seen this at all ages, and it's affecting the young, and it's affecting, you know, those who are 65 and older as well in ways we've never imagined. I think beyond the pandemic, the great challenge that we'll have is the behavioral health crisis that's affecting our country. So you think about brand and demand as it relates to mental illness, as it relates to how do you get people to change their mindset around their experience of life. I think there's a long road ahead once this pandemic subsides and we get into vaccination phase. Somebody made a comment to me recently, and I thought it was quite lovely. Hopefully, like in the roaring 20s, we'll experience a renaissance in this country. And because almost everything has had to change, you know, our behavior, our experiences, the way we think about going to work and going to school and experiencing play and exercise. Americans in particular are remarkably resilient and creative. And I think we'll find unique ways to reconnect again with folks and help family members who we've been disengaged with because of distance challenges feel better about their human connection. We need to use technology effectively. And I think the companies that recognize, particularly in healthcare, that if in fact they bring to life the value proposition that their brand has, and then create some sort of a demand structure that gets people to recognize its importance, again, this combination of brand and demand, they'll win in the long term. Consumers will win as well because they'll recognize the value that these brands are bringing, that it's really tangible, and we can live our lives in a healthier, in a better state.
Beautifully put. And you also folded in there part of the rationale for why I would give up my data, because if, you know, you track my silver sneakers, and I'm not saying that I'm wearing them yet, but if you did track my steps in them, then that, you know, saves me some money, et cetera. And then it reinforces my health behavior. I get it. Thank you.
Absolutely.
And then also it's interesting about the roaring 20s coming right after the 1918 flu epidemic. So, yeah, perhaps there is light at the end of the tunnel that ain't a train.
There is light at the end of the tunnel.
All right. So your New Year's resolution, your health resolution, you already seem incredibly fit. You know, you're showing off there with your Fitbit, you know, and rubbing it in for me. But what else could you do more? What do you intend to do better in 2021?
So, you know, I think because we're all sitting at home more and sitting behind a desk and being on Zoom calls all day, one of the things I did in the last few weeks was actually buy a standing table that through a little hydraulic goes up and down, and I can sort of mix up my day. So typically I'll do one sitting meeting, then I'll take my laptop and put it on my little standing unit and I'll stand. And I take at least two walking meetings a day, weather permitting. And that's great, particularly if the person on the other end is not watching you walk. And I've got noise canceling headphones that are fantastic, so they can't hear me as I walk, you know, briskly outdoors. But I think those are the things that I'm going to continue to do that'll help me, you know, remain mentally balanced and physically healthy. And I challenge everybody to think about how they can change their behavior in the new year, because I think particularly in the last 6 months, we've all become quite sedentary without being able to go to the gym or run around without a mask on. It creates a bit of a challenge. So how do you do that and mix it into your day when now the lines have been blurred between your personal time and your professional time? Do it with a smile, do it with exuberance, and just get out there and mix up your experience throughout the day.
Oh my gosh, I think the gauntlet has been thrown and I'm going to pick it up and I'm going to stand up more. So I do have to get that standing desk going. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Well, I hope you got some good inside scoop from this episode of Insider Interviews with me, E.B. Moss. And I also hope that you'll rate, review, subscribe wherever you download your podcasts. You know the drill, Apple, Stitcher, Google, iHeart. Thanks again for listening.